Good morning. It's 10:15. I'm calling this meeting of the Tax Committee to order for March 18th, 2026. The first item on the agenda is adoption of the minutes. For March 17th, Representative Elkins, would you like to move the minutes?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins has moved the minutes for March 17th. Is there any discussion on the motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion carries. The minutes for March 17th, 2026 are adopted. So today we have one bill up on the agenda, but first we're doing something a little bit different. For the Tax Committee is we're going to have a conversation about HCMC and hospitals sort of more broadly in our state. We'll also pull in some of those perspectives. And, you know, so I think all of us saw, at least in the media, the really concerning news about the financial situation of Hennepin County Medical Center, which is the largest level one trauma center in the region. It is the state's safety net hospital. It serves people from all 87 counties in the state. I know that for each of us, there are people who live in our districts who have been touched by HCMC. For those of us who, like me, live in South Minneapolis, it's just our hospital. It's where our babies are born and where we take our kids if they break their arm. But it also has these, you know, really high level capacities for, you know, specialty services. If you get a major burn, you want to go to HCMC. If you get shot by a gun, you want to go to HCMC. We know that recently when the Annunciation shooting happened, the victims of that shooting were rushed to HCMC, and the doctors came and talked about their experiences that day, and they probably wouldn't say it, but others, you know, have said that if those shooting victims hadn't ended up at HCMC, we may have had an even worse outcome. And so, you know, Governor Walz presented his budget yesterday. He got up and talked about HCMC as just too important an asset in our state to fail. And I know that so many of us around the table understand the stakes of that. I want to thank Co-Chair Davids for his just digging into this issue really seriously. We did invite the chairs of the Health Committee, Chairs Backer and Bierman. They might be joining us. They're welcome to join in the discussion. And Chair Schumacher was invited, as well as Representative Nadeau. So we're going to be hearing from the Minnesota Department of Health, from the Minnesota Hospital Association, from the county and from HCMC, and from North Memorial Health, which is another level one trauma center that serves the metro area and that is a critical part of, you know, the fabric of care that's provided to residents of our state, and also is facing financial challenges. So that's the what's on the agenda for today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm very thankful today that you're holding this hearing. Some might say, well, this is Health and Human Services. Well, not completely. There's a lot of tax implications involved in the issues we're going to be hearing about today. And I think maybe some of the solutions may come through this committee. But I just want everyone to know that I'm very committed to working something out here. So again, Chair, thank you very much for holding this hearing. And I'll be paying very close attention, and I hope we get some ideas on how we can move forward and make this thing work, because it's a very, very important asset, both HCMC and North Memorial. So thanks for holding this hearing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So we'll just jump right into it. Minnesota Department of Health is up first. Stefan Gildemeister, the Health Economics Program. We have all the materials in your packets. Please follow along. I don't know if you are open to questions as we go, or you want me to wait till the end.
It's the chair's choice.
Okay. I like questions as we go, because that's like how I learn information. So if anybody has a clarifying question, please raise your hand and we'll get you on. Please introduce yourself for the record as you get started.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Minnesota Department of Health. and I'm the state health economist. Thank you for having me here today to provide some background information on hospital uncompensated care. I know you have a packed agenda, so I won't say too much about who we are, just in brief. The health economics program is how our role is to be the expert on the healthcare marketplace, and we cover issues such as access to healthcare services, the cost of care, and we monitor the healthcare marketplace for the state. Our information, our data are largely from Minnesota. We try to use empirical information to provide stakeholders, policymakers, and researchers solid information. Today, you asked me to talk a little bit about where the data come from that we use in our work, and then to provide a little background on uncompensated care. So really briefly, Minnesota has 125 acute care non-federal community hospitals. They are organized across 14 multi-hospital systems and 38 independent facilities. They're spread across the state. Some are small, some are large, and some, like HCMC, are significant, play a significant safety role, providing critical, often life-saving services across a really broad spectrum of therapies that we've all come to rely on. Oftentimes, hospitals are hubs in their communities and have affiliated clinics, pharmacies, home health, lines of businesses, skilled nursing facilities, and other vertically integrated services. In short, hospitals are really important to the healthcare infrastructure in Minnesota. Hospitals, by the fact that they are providing such a key role and delivering high-tech services, oftentimes account for about one-third of spending in the state in 2024. Because of the unique role that hospitals play in the infrastructure, the legislature requires submission of a range of data to the Department of Health. We receive annual reports, and we work with the Hospital Association as a vendor to take in these data and validate them on organizational structure, the volume of healthcare utilization, how many admissions are there, how many days were patients in the hospital, what's the occupancy, how many emergency room visits have we had, data on financing, revenue, expenses, margins, and information on the service profile and the staffing at each hospital. Hospitals also submit annual financial statements, balance sheet information, and encounter data, and soon they will pass on data on community health needs assessment and how they're spending on community benefit alliance with these assessments. Sort of the nature of the business, that data can be lagged or are lagged, typically 8 months or so at the end of the fiscal year. Hospitals prepare their reports, issue the annual financial statements, the data flow through processes and come to the health department within about 8 months. Other resources that we use and have available to analyze hospital trends include the IRS Form 990 that nonprofit hospitals submit, the Medicare cost report, submissions to CMS, the Centers for Medicare, Medicaid Services, and of course the all-payer claims database, which brings together claims on medical and pharmacy services into a uniform data set. Uncompensated care. Uncompensated care is really care comprised of two components, charity care and bad debt. And the reason we track uncompensated care is because we are interested in measuring the volume of care that represents lost revenue to facilities. And there are two components. And I would say lost revenue for hospitals emerges for a number of reasons. First, they are nonprofit facilities and deliver care to all patients as part of their nonprofit status. But secondly, also, there are federal laws requiring that hospitals stabilize any patient who comes to see them independent of their ability to pay. Charity care, then, one component is spending on care for individuals who are eligible under the facility's charity care or community care policy to receive free or discounted care. So there's a process, there's a policy, patients demonstrate their income, they typically have to show that they have sought eligibility for public program services. If they qualify for charity care, they may get free or discounted care. Bad debt, on the other hand, is spending that the hospitals expected the patient to pay for, but the patient, for a variety of reasons, never met that expectation. In alignment with the notion that uncompensated care is for lost revenue, we compute uncompensated care on a cost basis. Charges, the price list that hospitals maintain, is viewed sort of as unrelated to actual revenue that can be generated. What's the trend in uncompensated care in Minnesota? As this chart shows across all hospitals, uncompensated care has been rising, and it amounts to a substantial volume of spending. For 2024, the latest data we have available at the moment, hospitals collectively spend about $444 million across charity care and bad debt. Looking at this volume of spending across charity care and bad debt, charity care in blue, bad debt in green. Bad debt typically is about 60% of uncompensated care, charity care, with some variation over the years between 40 and 50%. I think the 2024 number represents about 50% of charity care represents about 50% or slightly above 50%, 54% of uncompensated care.
Oh, Mr. Gildemeister, could I just ask you a question on this one? Thank
Absolutely.
You. Okay, so I'm looking at this chart, and the big jump from 23 to 24 in the amount of charity care stood out to me. And I know that that the cost of a service at a hospital is not like a thing that exists in a tag on the shelf. It seems to me like, from my understanding, that depending on a lot of different factors, you know, the cost at a single hospital for a procedure can be different depending on the patient, for example. And so I guess I'm just, as we're looking at trying to understand this part of hospital financing, how can I understand the sort of objective way that hospitals report charity care, and how do we know that we're comparing apples to apples? Like, how do we know that one place isn't charging four times as much on their calculation of charity care as another facility providing a similar service?
Madam Chair, it's a really good question, insightful. Within limits, we're seeking to standardize the charity care. So what I mean by that is absolutely, prices do differ across hospitals, but they typically differ across payers, meaning hospitals will charge commercial patients and Medicare patients and Medicaid patients different levels. In this case, hospitals report a charge-based charity care and bad debt, and using an industry standard approach, we compute a cost-to-charge ratio and multiply it to produce what we call a proxy for healthcare cost. So as much as we can standardize charity care spending, we do it in this analysis. and as I said, using approaches that are really standard across the industry.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I get caught in this area all the time of charity care and uncompensated care or bad debt. And what hospitals put into it, and I've never gotten the explanation on this, about if an insurer doesn't pay, they pay at 80%, and the hospitals accept that as full payment, is the 20% now part of the bad debt or part of the charity care that they didn't collect? That's first question. And then the other one will be, when does bad debt become charity care? Or isn't there a definite line there that hospitals, once they write it off, is that now charity care? And is that what's being accounted in your numbers? Thank you.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, I'll do my best to answer a complicated question. I think to an extent, it would be helpful to ask hospitals how they operationalize these processes. My understanding is charity care and bad debt are defined in rule, administrative rule. And there are some processes that are identified in rule, meaning the process hospitals have to undertake to affirmatively assess whether a patient is eligible for charity care. So what do I mean by that? There are income breakoffs. When the patient does not initially submit information on income or insufficient information on income, it is the hospital's responsibility to seek additional information to determine eligibility. At some point, if the patient does not participate, the hospital would have to assume it is bad debt because the patient has a responsibility there. And then the hospital might collect on that bad debt within the debt collection practices that the legislature updated, I think, 2 years ago. So there's law around how hospitals must approach the collection of healthcare debt. Secondly, on your question about cost sharing, so absolutely, patients are responsible for a share of the cost under most insurance policies, whether it's a deductible that is present typically in the earlier part of a policy year, or whether it's cost sharing in terms of coinsurance or sort of a fixed amount of cost sharing. Again, the hospital is in the unfavorable position to have to collect small amounts from many patients. And that represents certainly an administrative burden. Again, when the patient does not meet that obligation, the hospital has two options, considering whether the patient is eligible under the charity care policy and then can write off or discount the amount of cost sharing, or consider it bad debt, or aim to collect on it and write off a portion of that bad debt. But hospitals, under their mission, with their processes, the technology that they have available, and to adjust to the new debt collection requirements, will most likely use different processes in how rigorous or how demanding they are in the process.
Thank you. Chair Davids?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Gildemeister, we have the chart or graph up there. Does the Department of Health have that broken down to per hospital?
I think we're getting to that in a couple slides.
Oh, we are?
Yep.
Okay,
yeah.
I probably should have studied my...
No, it's okay.
A little better. Okay, thank you. I'll just wait till you get to it.
Okay. We have a couple other questions. Or do you need...
Go
Mr.
ahead.
Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, so long as you don't ask me about tax-related questions, I can supply much data on this topic by hospital, disaggregated, and I'll...
Great, thank you.
Take another step here.
Thank you. Oh, so, just, sorry, I had a couple of other questions. So, Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation. So, two things. One, 23 to 24, quite a rise in there, and I wondered if you had specifics on what was driving that. And then I know this is hard, but you've been doing this a while. And I just want to know if you have seen headwinds in healthcare like we are facing ever before, and how dramatic are you predicting? I suppose you don't predict, but your comments on what we as a state need to face here and the circumstances of hospitals being sort of the, you know, the worst situation I've seen in my years here. Thank you.
Mr. Gildemeister, you don't have to predict if you don't want to, but.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, these are really big questions, and again, I'll do my best to answer them. So the change in 2023 and 2024 coincides with ongoing increases in the cost of care. We see those increases in premiums in the individual market. We see those increases in the employer market. We see those increases in the across Medicare Advantage. There are some that there have been some benefits to patients, for example, in the Medicare Advantage place, where patients are expected to have some lower cost sharing on prescription drugs. But yes, the cost of healthcare is rising. It is rising faster than any, it's rising faster than inflation. It's rising faster than the economy, and it's rising faster than our wages and salaries. So that is a burden on patients. We have also documented in a press release last week, I think it was, that the rate of uninsurance has increased in Minnesota. What we have shared with the public is that the uninsurance rate between 2023 and 2025 rose from 3.8%, a historic low, to 5.8%, adding about 100,000 more individuals to the group of people who don't have insurance coverage. What does that mean? They have to pay more care out of pocket. They might delay care, and when they come to the hospital, they might be facing more complex health conditions resulting in higher cost of care, a portion of which then the hospital would absorb through uncompensated care. This is not a causality, so we are not at the position where we can demonstrate that two facts are related. So there's conjecture, but as we think about the drivers of uncompensated care, it's the economy, and I have a slide on that. It is access to care, and it's the cost of care, and it is also the law that wraps around the responsibility that patients and hospitals have. So I think there's a strong correlation at minimum. To the question of headwinds, the hospital market is very diverse, and it's really important to recognize that. We have billion-dollar hospital systems that are doing incredibly well financially because they are able to get high reimbursement for the services that they provide. Double-digit operating margins growth, significant financial assets investments. But we also have, and we have freestanding hospitals that have market power that can also generate considerably favorable prices and revenues. But we also have safety net hospitals that are, like HCMC, struggling, and North Memorial, struggling with higher uncompensated care, a considerably high Medicaid caseload, patients who have more complex healthcare needs and therefore have long lengths of stays, deliver mental health services that are low reimbursed services. So yes, definite headwinds. We are in the business of projecting future events, and we are wrapping up an analysis of the impact of HR1 on coverage in the economy, and we're happy to share those with you. The bottom line is, it is going to be a greater struggle for more hospitals in the state.
Thank you. Repley, we'll get to you after we get through the rest of the presentation. Please continue.
Madam Chair, typically we try to, when we look at the burden of uncompensated care, we try to put it in the context of the financial situation of hospitals in the industry. So here, and this is to an extent in additional response to your question, Chair Bierman, that I didn't fully answer. When we look at historical pictures, there are sort of two dynamics that we're observing. Number one, since the ACA that expanded Medicaid, we have seen a favorable picture of uncompensated care relative to operating expenses. So what we're seeing here, prior to 2014, hospitals spend greater than 2% on uncompensated care. And I want to say really clearly, the percent varies greatly across hospitals. It also varies across geography. Rural hospitals, for example, tend to spend higher amounts of uncompensated care relative to operating expenses, partly because their operations generate lower revenues. But so we've seen a recent decline in the volume, in the ratio of uncompensated care to operating expenses, with the exception of 2024. But we also see that Minnesota compares favorable across the nation in aggregate. And why is that? Because we have a strong employer-based market, relatively, even in the course of increasing uninsurance, we have a higher rate of coverage than the nation. So that explains the difference, at least as it looks to me. To get to some hospital-specific numbers, as part of our analysis, we look at the top 10 providers of hospital uncompensated care here, and Madam Chair, you've pointed to Hennepin Healthcare and North Memorial. They're both on this list. Hennepin Healthcare, HCMC, stands a bit on its own in the volume of cost-based uncompensated care. They provide 90.4 million in 2024, which represents a 40% increase relative to 2023, a dramatic jump in uncompensated care. HCMC's uncompensated care also accounts for a much larger share of operating expenses compared to any other hospital in the state. And then sort of just looking at the math and the distribution, the last column here shows you the share of each hospital's uncompensated care relative to the state's total uncompensated care. And again, Hennepin Healthcare stands out here in comparison to other hospitals. We think of Hennepin Healthcare and Regions Hospital as the two anchor safety net hospitals in the metro area. And I think these numbers underscore that. But to the earlier question on do we have this for all hospitals, absolutely. I'm happy to provide the committee with data for all hospitals and also over time. Madam Chair, I know you're eager to go on.
Sorry, Mr. Gildemeister. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Gildemeister, could you please email that to me? We've got the biggest, the biggest ones, but I'd like to see the entire state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, happy to do so. I have a few more slides. Great. They're quick, I promise. To the earlier question from Representative Hewitt, yes, both insured and uninsured patients account for uncompensated care. Here, we're looking at the left side, at the percent of total uncompensated care that the uninsured patients account for, and on the right-hand side that the insured patients account for. I think this slide makes sense. The uninsured patients account for more uncompensated care than the insured patient, just because they don't have the benefit of insurance benefits covering some of their costs. For charity care, it's 75%. For bad debt, it's a lower amount, 53%. And then across both components, about 65%. If you look at the insured, we want to think that patients have solid financial protections through the insurance benefits, but given that insurance benefits vary, that patients' income vary, and that they may face deductibles that are considerable relative to their financial assets, we see about a quarter of the uncompensated care going to insured patients, almost half of the bad debt going to uninsured patients. Going to insured patients.
Thank you. Chair Youakim had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I was looking at on the last chart on 11, if you just looked at the percentage of change, that would be a little bit misleading, wouldn't it, since each hospital, like you said, is so different and can weather that percentage differently. I want to thank you just for putting that percent of operating expenses in there, because that gives us a clearer picture. And the hit to Hennepin Healthcare is so much bigger when it comes to that change in uncompensated care. So thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair. Earlier, I sort of pointed out that there are various factors that might drive the change. In this case, I think some of you will also recall that the Attorney General had an agreement with, has reviewed Mayo's provision of uncompensated care and debt collection practices. So some of this change, for example, that you see in Mayo, is driven by the negotiation between the Attorney General and Mayo. So various factors drive the change. So I agree with your observation. Madam Chair, unless there are any questions on this slide, I'll move to what is my last slide, and it's a summary. To summarize then, in absolute and as a percent of operating expenses, hospital uncompensated care in Minnesota have been substantial and have been rising in 2024. Compared to pre-ACA and national trends, uncompensated care as a percent of operations compares favorably, but there is considerable variation across facilities that is really important to take note of, and I'm happy to share that with you at the hospital level. Hospital uncompensated care, as I've demonstrated here, I think, is highly concentrated. Hennepin Healthcare alone accounts for 20% of statewide hospital uncompensated care. Minnesotans with insurance coverage account for more than one-third of hospital uncompensated care. So this is not just a problem or a symptom of lack of insurance coverage. And then lastly, the volume of uncompensated care that many of you have noted is affected by a range of factors. Access to insurance, coverage, cost of care, the economy, and then legislative requirements around debt collection practices. And I guess I should say the enforcement that the Attorney General, the enforcement authority the Attorney General has around charitable trusts. And Madam Chair, plenty of additional resources that we can bring to your discussion. If you've been really excited about HHS topics, I'm happy to come back and tell you much more.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the presentation. Representative Lee?
Yes, thank you, Chair. And it actually was really good. I went last because my question is about the debt collection practices that we passed in 2024. Not really about that, but just curious if the department is collecting data on how much of the bad debt is sold to third-party debt collectors and maybe like how much money is made from that.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, I want to say yes, but I should double-check my knowledge there. Hospitals do sort of as part of their accounting do two things. They set aside a reserve for bad debt, and then they report what they've written off. That might relate to earlier periods because collection of debt can take several months and possibly years to settle. If I may, I'd like to come back to the committee with a more informed answer.
Sounds good. Mr. McQuillan, just let me know if there's follow-up from his former life as a health expert. So he might have some information to share with you after committee. Representative Lee.
Yeah, no, I think that's great for us to just kind of see that transparency and understand that. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just was curious, as we talked about the rise in health care, is there any correlation or connection between hospitals and the hospitals trying to overcome the bad debt by raising prices, which then turn around makes the healthcare unaffordable again and then increases the bad debt? And is it a cycle that just keeps getting worse and worse, just trying to take care of the other item?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is a preponderance of evidence that market power drives prices. There may be incidents of cost shifting, but when we look nationally and locally at the relationship between price growth and input costs, there's not a strong correlation. Yes, of course, there's inflation and hospitals experience it. Yes, of course, labor costs are rising. Yes, of course, hospitals expand service lines, they upgrade facilities, they work towards being more attractive to patients, they try to create better environments for moms and parents to have their children. But the relationship that does not, from what we see on input costs, and it's a tricky business for hospitals because hospitals typically do not do cost accounting. But what we see from input cost, there's not really a direct relationship between prices and the underlying cost. I know that I might get beaten up over that, but I'm happy to provide the committee with the evidence that we see on that relationship.
Great, okay. Thank you. All right, Representative Neuer, Chair Neuer, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to get a clarity on the impact of HR 1, which has significantly changed, and also the changes, additional changes in the direct payment program for Hennepin. Will that increase significantly the number of uncompensated care and the debt for Hennepin?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I've noted, we're working on estimating the impact of HR 1 for Minnesota specifically, and I'm happy to share that with you when we're ready. The logic is as follows. HR 1 makes changes to financing. The amount of resources that come to Minnesota in support of hospitals in financing Medicaid. HR 1 makes changes to the affordability of premiums in the individual market by reducing the enhanced premium subsidies. HR1 changes administrative practices in the individual market. Renewal process for renewals, documentation for eligibility. HR1 also makes substantial changes to how Medicaid determines eligibility, how often it confirms it, and it requires certain patient populations to demonstrate that they are either eligible for Medicaid or that they meet work requirements. National data, and I think our data will confirm that, demonstrates clearly that more people will lose insurance coverage. Fewer people will be enrolled in the individual market. It's an economic truth. As the premium rises, economic actors, who we all are to some extent, imperfect though we are, will mean that we're sort of asking, can I afford this? Can I spend money on a policy that gives me a certain level of protection? Taking into consideration other pressures on our, in our lives, the income, the disposable income that we have, the expenditure priorities that we have. There is no question in my mind that more individuals will become uninsured. Some of them will delay care. Some of them will cut their drugs. More will pay out of pocket. Some will request charity care. There's no question in my mind that it will raise charity care and bad debt probably across the whole industry.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. All right, we're going to, Representative Wiener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any tracking methods by hospital as far as public versus private insurance? And does that correlate to cost? If we're at a, if we're looking at a county here, hospital, do they serve a higher percentage of public insured versus private compared to another another entity?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we track both the revenue and the expenses for patient care at the payer level. So we are happy to share the net amount of revenues or the net amount of income generated from Medicare patients, public program, Minnesota public Medicaid patients, Minnesota care patients, self-pay patients, and uncompensated care and commercial patients. So that information is absolutely part of the accounting that hospitals do and that, that we do. We can also demonstrate to you or share with you the portion of admissions or the portion of days or the portion of revenue by payer. That is part of routine analysis that we do and are happy to share it with committee chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. And you, I don't know if the hospitals themselves will cover the payer mix, but it's a really important question. I know that one thing that's stuck in my mind is that HCMC has 16% private payers, which is well below kind of the most of the facilities in the state. But I know that these guys, I've seen charts of the sort of percentage, especially of Medicaid. People sometimes put Medicare and Medicaid in one public payer kind of pie, but the reimbursement rates for Medicare are much higher than the Medicaid ones. So we really, if we're trying to look at what the impacts will be, especially moving forward in the next few years, we really need to, you know, zoom in on those Medicaid numbers. But Representative Wiener.
Well, that kind of takes care of my question. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any way we can get data from 2008 to 2014 on these numbers as well?
Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair.
Probably be a yes or a no?
A yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Roach?
That's it, thank you.
All right, great. Representative Elkins?
Thank you. Just continuing on the thread that Representative Wiener began. So, I mean, there are huge differences in and what hospitals get paid depending on what the what form of insurance is being used. So as mentioned, Medicaid is a lot less than Medicare. And the last study I saw, the commercial market, the insurers were paying, I think it was like 192% above Medicare. Wow. I think Mr. Gildemeister can probably confirm that. The last Milliman report said that average commercial insurance rate in Minnesota was about 192% of Medicare. So the hospital's revenues is heavily dependent on its mix of clients. So if you're a suburban hospital that is getting mostly commercial traffic, you're doing really well. If you're a center city or rural hospital, which has a much higher percentage of Medicare and Medicaid, you're in trouble. That's the basic problem.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. All right. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. Up next, Senator Benson has joined us from the Minnesota Hospital Association. Welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Michelle Benson. Before I speak on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association, I want to tell you about my first encounter with HCMC. My son was riding his bike with his cousins back where I grew up, far away from HCMC. He was going down a hill on a gravel road, and he fell hard, hit his head. He was taken by ambulance to our local hospital and was assessed by an ER doc who said, he needs to go to HCMC. And I thought, okay, we're going to get an ambulance, and this will be the longest ride of my life. But no, we got in a helicopter because he needed a helicopter. And we flew to the cities. I remember sitting in a helicopter, straddling the gurney that my son was strapped to, being squished between two flight medical personnel, them reassuring me for the entire ride. I remember the most beautiful blue sky and a Minneapolis skyline. Because when you are looking for hope, time compresses and memories freeze. We landed at HCMC. They opened the door, and they said, keep your head down. And I'm thinking, of course, I'm getting off a helicopter. I'm going to keep my head down. I jogged behind the people caring for my son. And from that moment, everything was a blur. Scans, specialists, nurses, medical residents, a near constant stream of activity. Eventually, they assured me that minor interventions would help the occipital lobe fractures, and the brain bleed would resolve on its own. Months of vigilance would be enough. That was the hope I was looking for when I arrived at HCMC for the first time. During my time on HHS committees, I rode in ambulances. I walked into emergency departments, pediatric ICUs, locked wards, new birth centers, and I encountered the people, the care teams who are there to give hope 24/7, 365. I encountered patients and families looking for the hope that hospitals provide. I hope the baby comes soon. I hope the margins are clean and they got all the cancer. I hope they can help my daughter before she hurts herself. I hope we get to see mom before she passes. Words like this are thought, spoken, prayed every day at Minnesota hospitals. Minnesota's hospitals are all interconnected. They depend on each other. They build coordinated plans. Maybe an emergency department had to go on divert and a nearby hospital has to staff up. Maybe a patient needs a transfer across town or across the state. These connections improve outcomes for patients and keep our resources balanced. Who plans for a response when a freeway bridge goes down? Hospitals are part of that response. Who plans for global pandemics? Well, frankly, nobody, but hospitals respond. Who plans for a mass casualty event because a terrorist might use a Super Bowl, a Final Four, or an Ed Sheeran concert to send a message? Hospitals are part of that response. Hospitals are connected, collaborative, and prepared. Now, On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and our 139 hospitals and health systems, I thank you for the opportunity to share the Hospital Association's perspective on Hennepin Healthcare and its role in Minnesota's healthcare system. Within that system, every hospital plays a role that cannot easily be replaced. Hennepin Healthcare is no exception. It is one of the essential pillars holding the structure together. Hennepin is one of Minnesota's level one adult and pediatric trauma centers and one of the state's most significant safety net providers. It operates the busiest emergency department in Minnesota with more than 100,000 visits annually. Its patient population is more than 75% publicly insured or uninsured. Nearly one-third of its patients come from Hennepin County, and in recent years, one-third of its patients come from outside Hennepin County. In recent years, 40% of those requiring trauma or burn specialty care travel from elsewhere in the state. This is not a county resource, it is a statewide resource. For rural and regional hospitals across Minnesota, Hennepin functions as a critical partner and backstop. When a patient suffers a life-threatening farm injury in southern Minnesota, a serious crash in greater Minnesota, a complex burn requiring specialized care, that patient is stabilized locally and transferred to Hennepin for definitive treatment. If that capacity were weakened, the impact would cascade across the entire delivery system, overwhelming emergency departments, straining specialty networks, and placing additional pressure on already vulnerable rural hospitals that have nowhere else to turn. Hennepin is also central to Minnesota's healthcare workforce pipeline. It trains one-third of the state's graduate medical education physicians and more than one-quarter of its undergraduate medical trainees. 43% of these trainees are people of color, helping Minnesota to build physician workforce that reflects our communities. It operates the only addiction medicine fellowship in the state. The majority of its trainees remain in Minnesota to practice, filling gaps in communities experiencing shortages in primary care, emergency medicine, and behavioral health. Through programs like Project Echo, Hennepin extends clinical expertise to providers in more than 50 counties, strengthening care delivery far beyond the metro. At the same time, Hennepin Healthcare faces severe financial strain that mirrors and magnifies the pressures confronting hospitals across the state. Uncompensated care is approximately $100 million annually. That includes tens of millions attributable to patients residing outside of Hennepin County. The system operates with roughly 5 days cash on hand. 5 days cash on hand. A margin that leaves almost no capacity to absorb an additional financial shock. And the worst may be yet to come. As the impacts of federal policy changes under consideration become clearer, every nonprofit hospital and health system in Minnesota faces the prospect of deepening losses that could call into question the viability of our statewide care system. These challenges are not theoretical. They are immediate, they are accelerating, and they will not be confined to a single institution. Minnesota's healthcare system depends on the strength of each of its parts, community hospitals and clinics, regional referral centers, tertiary trauma and specialty hubs. When one of these parts weakens, the consequences are not local. They ripple outward and across the state. Hennepin Healthcare is one of the pillars that rural hospitals, regional systems, and patients across Minnesota depend on in critical moments. If it falters, every Minnesotan, urban and rural, will feel the consequences. Preserving the strength and stability of Hennepin Healthcare is not simply a local concern. It is a matter of statewide health security. Hennepin Healthcare is a bellwether for Minnesota's healthcare ecosystem. Minnesota's hospitals are operating in one of the most challenging environments in decades. More than two-thirds of hospital patients in Minnesota are covered by programs that do not fully pay the cost of care. The result is a system with increasingly narrow margins, limited reserves, and little room for disruption. As you consider the needs before you this session, please do not place new mandates on hospitals. Do not disrupt existing resources. And please consider reforms and funding that support and stabilize the 24/7, 365 hope that our hospitals provide. Madam Chair and members, I'll answer questions as best I can. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Any discussion now, or should we? I'm sure there will be more at the end. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Yep, and Senator Benson will be around if there are other questions later on in committee. Great. Thank you so much for being with us. Up next, HCMC, Hennepin County, Commissioner Conley. Not sure if you cover it. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Not sure if you cover it, but as distressing as the information that Senator Benson just shared with us, that HCMC has 5 days only of cash on hand. I believe that was the case before the UCARE went down, and now we do not. They do not have 5 days cash on hand. Last time I spoke to you, so maybe you'll address that at some point in your presentation. Thanks so much. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
So, good morning, Madam Chair and Chair Davids and members. My name is Angela Conley, and I am the Hennepin County Commissioner for District 4, which includes Hennepin County Medical Center. Thank you for having us this morning to provide a financial update on Hennepin Healthcare System, including the flagship hospital, Hennepin County Medical Center, as well as to give some of the incredible providers a chance to share the impact of their work today. Hennepin Healthcare is a nationally recognized Level 1 adult and pediatric trauma center, a teaching hospital, and the largest Medicaid provider in the system. And a health system near and dear to my own heart. I gave birth to 2 of my 4 children there, and it's where I received life-saving care after surviving a heart attack just 3 years ago. Every year, they treat thousands of patients from outside of Hennepin County, from greater Minnesota, neighboring tribal nations, and even bordering states like Wisconsin, Iowa, and the Dakotas. As you'll hear from some of today's testifiers, their impact is truly felt in every corner of our state. Today, I'll provide an overview of the hospital's current financial position, as well as what it is facing. What's facing the hospital over the next 10 years as HR 1 is fully implemented. As many of you know and have heard in the news, Hennepin Healthcare is facing significant financial challenges today, and this is due to a number of different factors. The Change Healthcare Security event last year, as well as the dissolution of UCARE this year, are both significant factors that have hurt the hospital's cash flow position. Prior to its dissolution, UCARE was Hennepin Healthcare's biggest payer. The end of the public health emergency in 2023 meant the end of presumptive eligibility for Medicaid, meaning many people lost their insurance coverage though their need for healthcare continued. Medicaid is the hospital's biggest payer, so for people to lose their Medicaid coverage, it was detrimental to the hospital's finances. And that's because 3 in 4 patients are uninsured or publicly insured. The hospital has seen a 5-year increase in uncompensated care. In 2020, it was $40 million. And in 2024, they saw $104 million in uncompensated care. About 24% of those costs came from outside of Hennepin County. Hennepin County currently levies $38 million per year in property taxes to mitigate these costs, and that's up from $28 million just a few years ago. And there are, of course, other factors like the lack of adequate reimbursement, increased staffing costs, delays to discharge that create backups, and inflation that place detrimental financial strains on the health system. Additionally, the payer landscape continues to deteriorate due to the loss of ACA subsidies and Minnesota care eligibility changes. So today, the hospital finds itself with a need to immediately stabilize its operations. This includes finding $50 million in savings this quarter. The reason Hennepin Healthcare System is open today is because Hennepin County is able to act as a temporary financial backstop for the hospital through a line of credit, essentially acting as overdraft protection. However troubling the short-term financial concerns are, they pale in comparison to the impact that HR 1 will have on our hospital. Hennepin Healthcare is set to lose an estimated $1.7 billion over the next 10 years. $1.1 billion of that
is the decline in directed payments, and the remainder is due to estimated increases in uncompensated care from individuals who qualify for Medicaid but will get disenrolled due to the added hoops and eligibility requirements put in place in H.R. 1. The county will not be able to make up those gaps through property taxes. While I'm confident we will prevail in securing the dedicated revenue that's needed to stabilize this hospital, this session, I must highlight some of the consequences if HCMC were to close. The state safety net will begin to unravel. Hennepin Healthcare sees 100,000 emergency room visits every single year. If the hospital closes, people will be forced to travel further for their care, pay more for their care, and thousands will go without care at all. Hospitals, especially across the seven-county metro area, will see increased wait times for all patients in their emergency departments. A closure would mean rural hospitals and metro hospitals may not have a place to send the most complex trauma cases, severe burn victims, and indigent care. Hospitals will be forced to absorb increased uncompensated care in their budgets as the people without insurance or with inadequate insurance seek care. That will drive up the cost of care everywhere in the state. At a time when rural health systems are under increasing financial stress, a closure at Hennepin Healthcare would have a dangerous domino effect across the state. A closure would also mean that Minnesota will not have the healthcare workforce we need to meet the available jobs. Hennepin Healthcare trains nearly 50% of all doctors who practice in Minnesota. Hennepin Healthcare also provides trainings and best practices to providers across the state through their Project Echo trainings. Madam Chair, Chair Davids, I would be remiss if in closing I did not call out the fact that despite the stress of the pandemic, despite the stress caused by recent federal government actions, which has had significant impact on our health system, both the workers and the residents who have delayed receiving care, and despite the disinvestment in healthcare at the federal level, the employees of HHS continue to show up for work with passion, with dignity, and with care for their patients and the important work that they do as a safety net hospital. With that, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Walsh with Hennepin Healthcare System. Dr. Walsh.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Conley. While they're getting settled, how many employees, or maybe Ms. Young, how many employees work at HCMC?
Madam Chair, Liz Young with Hennepin County. It's about 7,500 employees in downtown Minneapolis.
I think my city told me they're the largest employer in downtown Minneapolis and thus probably one of the larger employers in the city. So just wanted to point that out. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Walsh. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Megan Walsh, and I'm an internal medicine doctor, and I serve as the chief academic and research officer and president of the medical staff at Hennepin Healthcare. I'm here to share some insights about how our teaching hospital helps train the future healthcare workforce in Minnesota. As an academic medical center, we pair research and innovation to prepare and diversify the future workforce. This is especially important as we face a serious rural physician shortage. So first, I would like to ask you to do one simple thing. The next time you see your primary care doctor, your cardiologist, your child's pediatrician, ask them, where did you do your residency? Where did you do your fellowship? Where were your clinical rotations in medical school? There's a strong chance the answer is going to be at a Minnesota teaching hospital, and there's an even better chance that they're going to say Hennepin Healthcare. I'm here to share why sustained and increased investment in our teaching hospital is not an urban issue. It's a statewide workforce strategy. And without it, clinical research and education that Minnesota depends on are at risk. We at Hennepin operate 22 accredited residency and fellowship programs, including dentistry, primary care, emergency medicine, general surgery, cardiology, psychiatry, hyperbaric medicine, and partner with the University of Minnesota for an additional 40 specialties per year. We train a third of all graduate medical education trainees in Minnesota and 60% of the undergraduate medical students. 70% of Hennepin's 2025 graduates remained in Minnesota for practice. That matters because right now over one-third of rural providers plan to retire within 5 years. By 2030, a quarter of rural Minnesotans will be over the age of 65. 80% of physicians practice in metro areas, while only 4% serve isolated rural towns. Are you aware that there are only 2 child and adolescent psychiatrists in all of northern Minnesota? This is why, in 2025, we launched what may be the only partnership of its kind in the nation with Sanford Health in Bemidji. Emergency medicine and psychiatry residents began month-long rural rotations in Bemidji. That partnership is now expanding to internal medicine, surgery, family medicine. This is not a short-term staffing patch. This is a pipeline strategy. It changes how young physicians see rural medicine as a calling and a career. When rural hospitals close, communities decline. When surgeons retire without replacement, trauma care disappears. When psychiatry is unavailable, emergency departments become holding units. But wait, we are not just a physician training hub, but we train an entire workforce. We teach nursing students and advanced practice providers, imaging and laboratory technicians, paramedics, and EMTs. Investment in teaching hospitals directly stabilizes rural Minnesota as it does urban Minnesota. Research at Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute also leads initiatives that reach the entire state. We lead statewide data efforts through the Minnesota EHR Consortium to produce data that improves policy and practice in Minnesota. This data is now used by nearly every county health department in the state for community health assessments and setting health priorities. We implement and evaluate statewide efforts to expand integrated behavioral health care in both urban and rural portions of the state. We lead national data efforts focused on kidney transplant that guides fair allocation of organ donation. We lead a regional addiction research center that has participated in the largest studies in the country to identify ways to effectively treat substance abuse. This is a statewide investment. Urban teaching hospitals are the workforce engine for rural Minnesota. If you represent a farming district, a lake community, a small town hospital, this matters to you. If you want trauma surgeons in northern Minnesota, if you want psychiatrists in greater Minnesota, if you want addiction treatment available outside the metro, if you want your constituents to age in place, then you must invest where physicians are trained. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Dr. Nathaniel Scott, please just introduce yourself for the record as you get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nate Scott. I'm an emergency physician and the Vice President for Hospital and Acute Care at Hennepin Healthcare. I was also born in Minnesota, I'm a proud graduate of the University of Minnesota Medical School. I completed my residency training at Hennepin Healthcare and spent the entirety of my professional career there in service of our communities. I'd like to just take a few minutes to talk a bit more about some of the clinical care and services that we provide. At Hennepin Healthcare, we've been leaders in trauma care. We've been leaders for a long time. For more than 35 years, Hennepin Healthcare has been verified by the American College of Surgeons as a Level 1 trauma center, the nation's highest designation and the first in the state of Minnesota. It's been mentioned that our emergency department sees approximately 100,000 patients per year. Of those, about 3,000 patients are seriously injured enough to be cared for by our trauma program, and those include children and adults from all over the state, bordering states, and tribal nations as well. Whether it's a family from southern Minnesota suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning, child from northern Minnesota suffering a major burn, farmer from rural Wisconsin suffering an accident, we are there for them. And we're there because we have the expertise, the technology, and the commitment to care for the most complex cases, and our outcomes have reflected this excellence. We care for people from communities all over the state on their worst days. And these are not just abstract patients. These are our families, our friends, our neighbors. We submitted a few patient stories and patient testimony examples to help illustrate the life-saving care our teams provide every day. And you've heard a few others from testifiers here this morning. As Dr. Walsh mentioned, Hennepin Healthcare is known internationally for the emergency and trauma research that we do. And this innovation that isn't just innovation that stays locally at Hennepin, it spreads outward across the state, across the country, and internationally as well. We play a vital role in emergency preparedness. It takes enormous resources to be prepared to respond in the ways that have been described to disasters, to trauma that upend our communities in terrible ways, such as the Annunciation shooting last year, infectious disease emergencies and outbreaks, and many others. goes without saying, but if we're no longer able to serve Minnesotans in the way that we do today, this would have a profound effect on other health systems in Minnesota. In 2025, Hennepin Healthcare accepted nearly 1,600 patients from other hospitals for some of the core trauma, burn, and other services that we provide. We also accepted 500 other patients for other medical conditions. As of January, due to capacity constraints and our financial considerations, we've had to pause on accepting those other patients from around the state. There are very few other places that can provide the type of care that we do, and at the scale and at the quality that which we do it. There's only one other comprehensive burn center in the state and no other hospitals that provide emergency hyperbaric medical care. And these are services where minutes matter. Our patients simply can't be absorbed by other health systems. Many of you have become familiar with some of the challenges we face regarding discharge delays and how aware strained health systems are due to this issue, as finding safe post-discharge placement settings that will continue to accept patients with complex care needs is a challenge that we continue to face collectively. And patients, when patients cannot discharge from our hospital, our hospital beds quickly reach their capacity. The emergency department starts to back up with patients waiting for a hospital bed, and this also results in our health system being unable to care for trauma and other patients due to capacity constraints. This isn't a challenge unique to our health system. I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify today. Happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being with us. Dr. Scott, up next, Jessica Oaxaca, I think, is going to share a patient story with us. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jessica Oaxaca, and I'm the Advocacy Engagement Manager at Hennepin Healthcare, here to share a patient's story on behalf of Krista Steele, who is a nurse in an emergency department and couldn't be here today. Madam Chair and members, my name is Krista Steele. I am a nurse by trade practicing at a hospital in northern Minnesota, and I am here today to share how Hennepin Healthcare cared for my daughter and made a lasting difference for my family. On February 15th, 2018, my family was living in Princeton when my daughter Luna, who was 20 months old, sustained partial thickness burns to both of her hands after briefly touching a glass fireplace. I was 21 years old at the time, a single mother to Luna and my four-year-old daughter Lily. I had no medical background and no understanding of what was happening. As the blisters began to rapidly form on her hands, I was terrified. We were seen at a local emergency department and then transferred to HCMC for specialized burn care with plans for admission to the burn unit. By the time that we arrived, nearly 12 hours had passed since I had breastfed my four-month-old. I was physically exhausted, emotionally overwhelmed, and completely devastated watching my toddler in pain. I felt helpless and hopeless. From the moment we entered the ER at HCMC and throughout our admission to the burn unit, the medical professionals at HCMC demonstrated exceptional clinical skill and extraordinary compassion and awareness of the entire family. Without hesitation or prompting, they ensured I had access to a breast pump and even provided a mini refrigerator to safely store milk for my other daughter. They recognized that while Luna was the patient, I was also a mother in crisis, trying to take care for two babies under unimaginable stress. They went far beyond routine care. They provided reassurance, education, dignity, and support during one of the most traumatic nights of my life. Their calm confidence, empathy, and professionalism carried me through a moment where I truly felt I might collapse from emotional distress. Today, Luna is 9. She is in her fifth year of competition dance and loves art. The doctors were worried about contractures in her hands from the burns that she sustained at a young age. So the fact she ended up with no contractures and loves art and dance is simply amazing. Because of the care we received at HCMC, I was inspired to pursue nursing. I became an LPN in 2021, an RN in 2022, earned my BSN in 2024, and completed my Master of Science in Nursing and Public Health Nursing this January. Their example of compassionate, family-centered, expert care is something I carry into every single patient encounter. As I progressed in my career, beginning as a new nurse in a rural critical access emergency department and later managing the stroke and trauma program, I gained firsthand understanding of the pace, pressure, emotional intensity, and competing demands that ER and critical care nurses face every shift. Knowing what I didn't know then makes their compassion even more remarkable. Despite the trials, high acuity, and constant demands of emergency and burn care, they consistently provided patient-centered, passionate, and deeply human care. That level of presence is not accidental. It is exceptional.
The way they treated me and my children, not just clinically but humanly, changed the direction of our lives. I will forever be grateful for the care the healthcare professionals at Hennepin Healthcare provided my daughter with and for the quiet but powerful way they inspired my own career in nursing. Thank you for the opportunity to share my story.
Thank you very much, Ms. Oaxaca. We're going to move now to further member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who would be the right person to ask this, but it has to do with Hennepin County, the HCMC, and the recent news that 100 beds were eliminated. I'm just wondering, any of the actions that get taken, are those permanently gone, or are those, you know, available for opening again if something gets done?
Looks like Dr. Scott is joining us.
Madam Chair, those are temporary bed reductions to help stabilize expenses related to staffing. We anticipate revisiting the needs and what is, you know, and we're monitoring hospital finances daily and as well as needs for around the state, and that is a decision that our co-administrators have indicated we will revisit as necessary as time goes on.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. Were those beds empty, or were those beds filled and basically thus you're not able to help those patients?
Dr. Scott?
Yeah, as I had mentioned before, we have stopped accepting some transfers around the state in parallel with that bed reduction. So there are a certain number of patients that could come here for services that we are not accepting due to those, that bed capacity reduction.
Okay.
Representative Johnson?
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Agbaje?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question might be better for Hennepin County, but the hospital could also answer too. You talked a lot about kind of the challenges facing HCMC right now and the threat to its closure and what happened. So I wonder if you could kind of walk us through a little bit further. Maybe, A, what have you begun to do in the face of some of these cuts and these challenges? And is there a type of wind down kind of happening right now?
Commissioner Conley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm going to ask Mr. Oppie to come and speak to that.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself as you get started.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioner. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Abdurrahman Abdi. I'm the new Chief Financial Officer for Hennepin Healthcare. We have done several things to stabilize the organization and align our resources to be more effective and efficient. It includes the reducing of the beds that Dr. Scott talked about. We've also frozen wage increases. We've reduced some programs. We've also stopped doing any capital improvements at this point. So those are some of the steps that we have taken. We're looking at more opportunities to be more effective and efficient as we look at our cost. We're projecting for 2026 that, again, we're going to have an operating loss of $40 to $50 million. So we're taking actions to stabilize the organization and be more effective and efficient.
Representative Agbaje?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for those numbers. I mean, I think it just kind of shows how dire things are. I mean, one of the things I sort of am trying to also get at, too, is because HCMC is our public safety net, from there, especially if you're already starting to reduce beds and do some, you know, freezing of wages and capital investment and all that type of stuff, are other hospitals, do you know, beginning to kind of feel the impact of that if you're turning away patients?
Mr. Abdi?
Madam Chair, Commissioners, I don't have the information related to how other hospitals are feeling, but it does impact when Hennepin Healthcare is not able to take on patients. That increases other hospitals on taking those patients. So there's a direct impact to some of the things that we're doing. We've talked about reducing some programs related to things like sleep medicine as well as pain management and organizing some of our services. Those programs will, but the reduction of those programs will have impact on other health systems because those patients, I need to go to those other health systems who have those services.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then my last question before final comment. I think I saw in there that the trauma patients or the burn patients, at least 40%, are from outside Hennepin County. Do you know at least hospital-wide how many people are coming from to the hospital from outside of Hennepin County?
Yeah, I don't have the exact number. That's something that we can get you, Representative.
Ms. Young.
Madam Chair, Representative Agbaje, it's about 31% or close to a third of patients overall that come from outside Hennepin County.
Thank you. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just, you know, again, to put a finer point on this, this is our statewide hospital, for a lack of a better term. We have patients not only in Hennepin County, but across the state who are coming here. We've heard some of the patient stories. I think it behooves us, particularly in this committee and, of course, other committees across the legislature, to ensure that we provide some type of way forward for the hospital to ensure that it stays around and ensure that it doesn't create some type of additional detrimental spiral to the other hospitals in our system. We all know everyone is facing the hard burden and of uncompensated care, and I do think that's something we definitely need to address, but we seem to have an emergency in front of us, so I hope we will take that seriously. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Chair Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to first thank you for coming and testifying, and thank you for giving my doctor the medical training that she needed. She's a doctor now. She did one of her rotations in nephrology there and did a research project before that. But besides that, I know we talk a lot about the trauma center that you provide for people around the state. It has been mentioned a few times, and I find this fascinating, and maybe people would too, with the only hyperbaric chamber in the state. Some people think of that as just, oh, if somebody's going diving and we're a landlocked state, so why do we need that? Could you maybe describe some of the ways you're using that chamber, the only one in the state, and also some of the new treatments that you're doing around wound care with that?
Dr. Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you for those comments and questions. Carbon monoxide poisoning is a major thing that our hyperbaric chamber does treat. There are some other hyperbaric chambers around the state, but ours is the only one used for emergency care 24/7. And so for things like carbon monoxide poisoning, we are a critical resource around the state in the upper Midwest for that. Wound care is something that we also use our hyperbaric chamber for. So that way it's used. It's used quite frequently. It's used daily for that. And so it's not just standing by for emergency care. We get good use of it for a wound care program as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know where to start. I'm going to start with a personal story that, as an EMS person that traveled the state and transported people by ground and by air, a lot of times to Hennepin County. And many times that we did this, we'd go out to these smaller hospitals around the state, and the first thing they would say was, well, we've been on the phone with Hennepin for probably about, let's just say, half the day. So Hennepin provides a real valuable service that the doctor didn't bring up here, is that the knowledge that they have in the ER or in the Hennepin in general isn't stopped at the door. It also goes to physicians in outstate to discuss the patient before they're even transported. And that just amazes me of how we don't know these little things that Hennepin has been doing. I've been traveling around the state recently, and somebody in Crookston this weekend was an ER nurse up there, and she said, oh, yeah, no, Hennepin, that's where if you're shot up here, you're going down there. Don't mean to use that expression, but that's the truth. A family that just recently suffered a burn that didn't turn out their way, but they knew that going to Hennepin gave them more time with their loved one. I get real frustrated about this. This is the representative said, this is a statewide asset. There isn't one first responder or one police officer in the state that doesn't know about Hennepin County Medical Center. We have to protect this at whatever the cost is, and I know people hate to hear that, but the truth is that this is, any of us around this table or anybody that's in this room, tomorrow morning could end up in Hennepin County Medical Center for various things. And I would tell you right now, personally, and this is what's neat to listen to the providers, because you heard a testimony of a nurse, is to hear where the nurse wanted their child to go. That's where I want to go. That's really where I want to go. And I want to touch on financials real quick, Chair, if you'll give me a certain thing. Everybody thinks trauma care is profitable. That's the most profitable part of trauma care. All of us around this table and some of us that are in commerce know that in each piece of insurance we issue, like the auto insurance, I think we all have to at least have 20K for medical expenses. 20K is basically taken up by the rural hospitals, so Hennepin gets the patient, and many of them are uninsured. The other thing I want to point out, and I'm just curious, and maybe somebody from Hennepin can answer this. Last year, I believe my health insurance took a 5% increase because of the hospitals requiring more money. I'm just curious, did the payers give Hennepin County 5% more, like Health Partners or Group Health, Health Partners or Blues? Because I'm just curious if you got 5% that I was charged.
Mr. Abdi, as our health care costs go up, do the strapped providers in our communities get more money?
Madam Chair, I can't talk specifically about specific contract with a payer, but I would just say that in general, our reimbursement, so we have 70% government reimbursement, and generally our rates increase anywhere between 2 to 3%. The commercial market depends on the plan, but roughly anywhere between 4 to 5, maybe 6% is what I've seen in the marketplace. But for us, it's different because of our payer mix. It's heavily government, 70% government, and because of that, we're seeing a lot lower increases relative to the market.
Yep, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, and that kind of helps me out. So there's probably some leeway in there, but I, from what I remember, this never paired well. Employees are paying 5% more, and then all of a sudden, they're in a, and you know, they're getting raised because they say we're charging them more or whatever. It's bizarre. Last thing I want to talk about, your charity care and your bad debt. What other sources does Hennepin County have, non-medical sources for bringing revenue in that might help with that? Do you have a foundation? Do you have a gift shop? Do you have lab services? And a mixture of all them, can you take care of your debt with this, or is it a big portion of what knocks off that debt?
Mr. Abdi?
Madam Chair, almost all of our revenue comes from services that we provide to our patients, with the exception of the support that we receive from the county. We do have a foundation that supports some programs, but it's not a direct revenue source for us.
Thank you,
Mr. Abdi. Don't be like me and start looking through the private hospitals' 990s compared to Hennepin's, because you will see that some hospitals in the state are sitting on literally billions and billions of dollars in their sort of like charitable foundation arm. And then there are organizations like Hennepin that just has a fundamental mismatch between the cost of the services they're providing and the money they're bringing in, and no way to offset it elsewhere, either in another facility that's doing better or in, you know, being a nonprofit that's sitting on billions and billions of dollars that is invested in the stock market and that they're getting, you know, gains off of. So is there any further discussion? Chair Neuer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My quick question is, because UK is going under receivership, and how does that impact Hennepin Healthcare?
Mr. Abdi?
Madam Chair, UK really impacted us significantly because it was our largest payer by far. And because of the dissolution of UK, we've lost significant cash on hand. And this is the reason why, you know, we had to go to the county to ask for assistance in terms of cash, days cash on hand. I know it was mentioned that our days cash on hand was 5 days. It's not. It's actually, it depends on the day. Sometimes we're negative, sometimes we're positive, depending on the revenue we're receiving from the services we're providing to our patients. But it was pretty significant, and we're working with the state to see what we're able to recover based on. We have upwards of $100 million that we're still missing from UK dissolution, and we're working through the channel to see what we can recover.
Thank you. Chair Noor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Exactly. I think there's right now you're facing some of the crisis because you don't have that more than $100 million that you should have had from UK. And you may not be able to recover some of that funding, or maybe all of that funding, depending on the timeline that, as we're aware of, it may even take 2 years for Hennepin to receive any portion of that funding, which I think that's why we are in, you know, financial crisis, added on the DPP program, the direct payment program, and the cuts that are going to be implemented starting next year. So, members, we've got more work to do. We need to be looking through different avenues to support the hospital, because this is a state hospital, not a county hospital. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Yeah, and as I understand it, you know, that's something that as a Hennepin County taxpayer and as somebody who represents tens of thousands of Hennepin County taxpayers, what's happening is that since UCARE went down, they do not, the hospital does not have the cash on hand to make their payroll obligations every 2 weeks. What that means is that the county is going into their reserves and lending the money to the hospital so that they can make their obligations day to day. And so, you know, of course, that is a very precarious situation, and we're thankful that they have the backstop of the Hennepin County property taxpayers. But as we all know, that pressure that comes on, you know, residential homestead owners, it kind of compounds. And, you know, so as we're talking about, this is a statewide resource. Well, those of us who live in Hennepin County are really footing the bill to kind of help them to make that cash flow happen week to week. And so that's sort of part of the reason for the need for intervention. So thank you. All right, not seeing any further discussion, I'm going to call up, thank you so much for being here,
thank
Commissioner Conley, Dr. Scott, Mr. Abdi, we appreciate your presence here. Please come on up, North Memorial. Trevor Sawalish and Bette Zerwas are joining us. Please go ahead and get started with your testimony as you get settled in. While they're getting set up, as you may have noticed, we're probably not going to get to Representative Lee's bill today, but I just really appreciate everybody's participation and that we have such an, you know, kind of engaged group of members talking about these important issues. So I think it's a worthwhile use of our committee time. And we'll hear Representative Lee's bill next week.
Apologies. Why don't we see if we can get it going and then we'll... Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. Very much appreciate this conversation. Healthcare is in dire need. And of course, it is not just an HCMC issue. It is not just a North issue. But I also do want us to recognize that between HCMC and North, we represent, I think in a shared way, an important safety net for the state. You know, frankly, we're the closest to the edge. So all of healthcare is moving towards the cliff, but some of us will fall first. So I appreciate the opportunity to be able to tell that story and share that story. We did provide some information in advance. Three things I wanted to accomplish today. One, just give you an overview of where North Memorial is today from a financial perspective and some of the choices that we face. And then the second thing is really to talk about what is our path forward, and then reemphasize some key takeaways here, and then certainly answer any questions. But as I said, you know, we look at our role as the other level one trauma center 6 miles away. We also serve 100,000 emergency department visits every year. We have roughly 3,000 trauma encounters every single year. We look at this as HCMC is a critical resource for our community. HCMC is not going to survive without North, and North will not survive without HCMC because we really do share this important function. North Memorial has roughly 75% of our patients that are on some sort of government program. And we've provided some data in the packet to talk a little bit about our financial situation. But the other thing that I would emphasize is that North Memorial, especially with our Level 1 Trauma Center and our statewide EMS system, including over 115 ambulances on the road every day and 9 helicopters, we really do serve all of Minnesota as well as a 5-state region. We'll just keep rolling.
We all have copies of the slide deck.
Yeah, thank you. I'll just refer to that.
Yeah, I think we're on getting to page 5.
Thank you. So the thing that I might emphasize again on page 6, which is just our statistics, you'll see a lot of similarities in some of those statistics, especially if you look at the 110,000 emergency department visits. 3,000 of those are trauma. Between 25 and 30% of those come from the outstate. transfers from other facilities. I appreciated the question that what's been happening to other hospitals as HCMC has decided to shut down some of the beds that they have. We're seeing a direct impact of that because those rural hospitals have to send patients that they can't safely care for elsewhere, somewhere, and North Memorial is certainly starting to see some change. On the next slide, talking about our payer mix and recognizing that Medicaid does not pay the same as government, but 75% government payment means that we don't get increases. We aren't able to absorb the costs and increases in costs that we have every single year. It is a significant challenge when only 25% of your business comes from commercial payers. Now, again, I appreciate that there's lots of different ways to look at that, but what it does mean is that at Robbinsdale Hospital, we do not run a sustainable operation. There is no way that in the long term we can keep the services going exactly as we do today because we lose, in last year, unaudited financial results, we lost $50 million at Robbinsdale Hospital, previous year $22 million at Robbinsdale Hospital. This gives you a little bit of a sense why, and I appreciate the MDH data is a slightly different view. I can appreciate that we have lots of different reports that we put out there, all of which look at slightly different angles. But what you're seeing here is off of our 990, which is also the is the IRS report that we submit every single year. We have roughly $70 million of uncompensated care between bad debt and uncompensated care or charity care. And then the underpayment in government, which I think is a continually growing component of this, gets us over almost $250 million in 2024 of care that we're not reimbursed for. This next slide is really how I look at the data. As the CEO for the health system and making choices about what we can and can't sustain, this is the most important view, is where do we have the ability to sustain our mission? As you can appreciate, healthcare is a capital-intensive business. We have buildings, we have high-tech equipment, we have ambulances on the road, we have helicopters. All of that requires us to sustain a margin. In 2024, we had one of our best years in recent history where we made $5 million. We're roughly a $1.2, $1.3 billion system, and we made $5 billion. That is not enough of a margin for us to sustain all the capital investments that we need to make. And I say that, knowing that behind every ambulance, behind every MRI, behind every building, there are patients that need us to have good quality equipment to care for them. So in 2024, we had one of our best years ever. In 2025, unaudited so far, it was a very different year. We lost $50 million at Robbinsdale Hospital and $30 million as a system. That's not sustainable. We can't continue to lose that kind of money. If you switch to the next slides, you can see exactly why. And this is not about money. That we are a not-for-profit healthcare organization. We're so lucky in Minnesota that so many of us that operate in healthcare are. But that does not mean that we can manufacture finances where they don't exist. The next two slides that you see is just our bond rating right now. North Memorial is just one step above junk bond status, which means anytime that we would need to take out a loan for any new equipment, any expansion, any services that we want to be able to provide, we're not going to be able to accept at a very high cost. The next is the days cash on hand. We've talked a lot about that from HCMC. Our days cash on hand are at 85 days, and the distinction that I might make here is we don't have any backstop. The county provides that backstop for HCMC. These 85 days represent all the money that we have to weather anything that might hit us. Every single payroll is over $20 million every 2 weeks for us. So any disruptions like we had with Change Healthcare last year, like we had with UCare this year, is going to have a very, very dramatic effect, and we're turning to that day's cash on hand. And as you can see, whereas 2020, we're almost 250 days cash on hand, we are quickly dwindling. We had to pull $50 million out of that bank account in order to fund operations last year. Not lost on anybody in this room is that it is only going to get worse. Everything that we are looking at, including cost of labor, cost of supplies, the changes in government programs, all of those are only going to exacerbate the situation. We pulled the headlines on the right-hand side there to show that in any given year, those would have been the headlines of the year. This is 1 week's worth of headlines. The uncertainty that's facing healthcare is profound, and certainly not giving us any optimism that we're going to be able to weather some of the challenges that are coming, given our precarious starting point. So the question is, what are we going to do about that? Certainly, we are going to be working to solve our own problems. We have done everything that we can to make sure that every dollar we spend at North Memorial is prioritized to patients. We have had reductions in force in 2024 and 2025. We have 9 fewer executive team members than we did 2 years ago because it is critically important that we run as efficiently as possible because healthcare truly is not affordable for everybody out there. That said, when we're facing the kind of headwinds we are, the challenges we are, we're not going to be able to solve this problem on our own. We can't cut ourselves out of this problem. We can't dig a deeper hole and think we're going to get out of this hole. And that really is something that I want to underscore, is that I think every single organization that I know in healthcare today is working really, really hard to solve this problem, but the challenges keep coming. And especially for organizations like HCMC, for organizations like North, that proudly take care of every patient, irrespective of the ability to pay 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, some of these challenges are just too great. Hence, we've been fortunate to be considered with Hennepin County in some of the discussions that we've had because we really do believe that we share that same safety net. So I do think this is about generally preserving services. We want to preserve the great services that HCMC provides. I would argue it's really very important to the state of Minnesota that we preserve the great services that North Memorial provides. And with that, I will take any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Is there any further questions? Representative Hewitt.
So I just real quick, and I know we're short for time here. And you're right, North has been really the backbone of the EMS system in the state, and I really appreciate that personally. But the question I have, you mentioned that you had 250 days of cash just shortly a few years ago. Could you quickly tell us what policies, what changed, because that sounds like it was just a couple of years ago. Something hit, either beginning of this year. When did? Give us a short timeline on when that happened, if you can relate anything to it. Thank you.
Yeah, the last several years. Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative, thank you for the question. What I would say, last couple of years, we have had to pull money out of our bank account to fund operations because we've had losses for the last several years. Going back to 2020, we also had some changes associated with Maple Grove Hospital where we bought out a partner at that point that had some bearing on the day's cash on hand. But the most recent trend, including 2025, where we used $50 million out of that long-term bank account to fund our operations is now the trend that we're facing.
Representative Hewitt.
Not hearing my answer here is, did you notice anything like insurance or whatever hit this that gave us a bookmark on it was a policy we did or something that changed in the payer mix or people are less insured in the last 3 or 4 years? That's kind of where I'm going at. What do you see in your data?
Mr.
Appreciate that, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yeah, a lot of the same trends that have already been well discussed today. So, you know, uncompensated care continues to go up. Mm-hmm. The thing that we haven't talked much about is even when you do have a commercial population, higher copays, higher deductibles, higher co-insurance that the hospitals then have to go and collect have also been part of our overall collectability of the increases that we've been able to have. Cost of care continues to go up, of course, on the labor side and on the supply side. So all of the same trends that are that we discussed are certainly having a bearing. What I would say is that we look forward to the changes to Medicaid. We continue to feel the number of folks that aren't on Medicaid anymore. You know, even though Medicaid doesn't pay great, it's better than zero. So as we've had changes in Medicaid population, we certainly have felt that, and we look forward and we see more coming.
Thank you. So we have 2 minutes. We have 5 people on the list. Anybody have like a speed dating type of question that they want to get in? Representative Norris? Maybe not.
Chair Gomez, I'm not sure how much of a speed dating question
okay.
is, but I do think it's relevant.
Absolutely. Please go ahead.
Thank you for the testimony. I've heard reports that on Friday you told staff at North Memorial that you're looking for an acquisition partner. I'm wondering, you know, as we're considering potential allocation of state resources here, if you can talk about, you know, what that's looking like for the hospital and how that might impact the need for state resources.
Thank you. Mr. Sawalish.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. Yes, we did share that with our staff. Again, you can look forward and see that as a $1.3 billion system, we unfortunately don't have the scale to sustain what we're doing right now by ourselves. So we are going to need to seek a partner. What I would say is it
doesn't really matter, however, what name is over the door. If Robbinsdale Hospital is losing $50 million, that is going to be a challenge for anybody who has an ownership stake in that that organization. And unfortunately, you know, there may be some changes that come with a new partner, but that doesn't in any way change the fundamentals of how sustainable we are as we stand today.
Thank you. We're going to just take a couple extra minutes, which we never do in tax committee. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but we have so many people on the list. Representative Lee, do you have anything quick?
Oh, yes. So very quickly, I was just looking at some of the slide presentations. So, you know, slide four says you had $78 million in uncompensated care in fiscal 24. But I was looking at Mr. Gildemeister's presentation on page 11, which breaks down the uncompensated care in each of the top hospitals. And that's just $12.1 million. So just trying to understand maybe what your definition of uncompensated care is.
Mr. Sawalish.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that. We became aware last night of the report that was going to be talked today. We haven't had a chance to fully reconcile that. The numbers that I'm using in the presentation are from our 990. What I can say is that we do a lot of public reporting. We have the hospital annual report. We have the 990s. We have our financial statements that are audited on the externally. We have, of course, the MDH reports, all of which use slightly different definitions for this. On the 990s, where I go back, probably is the one that I feel most confident speaking to. Charity care and bad debt was roughly $70 million in that view.
Thank you. Representative Lee, quickly.
Well, sorry, it's bad debt and what?
Charity care.
Charity care.
Oh, okay, yes, because the bad debt is like $34 million. Yeah, I'm looking at your 990s too. Yeah.
Yes.
That's across the system, I think, when you're looking at those 990s. So we have some, you know, data stuff to work out. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, and thank you for all you're doing. I think I'd love to get an update on where we are in the directed payments program, because that's an important part of this for North Memorial. HCMC does get federal directed payments because they're government-owned, and North could qualify. There was actually a deal where the county was going to help back that up, and then they pulled out of that. So we've been trying through our federal partners to get that. I know we passed legislation on it last year to qualify. Can you tell us where that stands and how that would make a difference?
Mr. Swalish.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, thanks for that question. Last year, thanks to the legislature, we did pass a statewide directed payment program that was facilitated by the MHA. We held a lot of hope that that could bring relief not only to North Memorial and HCMC, but the hospitals across the state. We don't believe, though, given a lot of changes at the federal level, that that is going to be a successful effort. We have not given up hope, but hope is not something that I can build into my financial and strategic plans. It does seem unlikely just based on everything that we've heard. We still hold hope that maybe, you know, whether it's a smaller package or something like that, that there would be some benefit, but certainly the policies at the federal level are in question at this point.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's yet another kind of choice made in HR1 that we're, as a state, going to be having to contend with, is basically phasing out directed payments, including that $1 billion that HCMC got in 2021, I believe. Representative Witte?
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I just want to say thank you both to you and Hennepin County for being here and explaining this. I've carried the bill before. It's great to have you guys here, have the smarter people in the room to give us an overview of this. I'll just leave it at this. It's a complex issue. And so I hope we can continue to work through it and look at all the different angles and kind of come together on it. So thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Great. Closing comments, Chair Davids.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'd like to request a resolution from Hennepin County to the legislature to kind of just lay out where the county's coming from. There are many, many moving parts here, and I think that would be helpful. And members, the solution is going to come from this committee. It's coming from right here. So some could say, well, you know, it's not the health committee, and they certainly have a big part to play in this, but it's,
they're
it's
not good. Here anymore.
It's
so.
Well,
I thought they'd all left.
I'm in the human service.
And Madam Chair, we're also off camera. So
thank goodness.
At this point, yes, yes. So I look at this as a package deal, whether it be under the current sales tax with the Twins to fix the county stadium, North Memorial, HCMC. In my mind, this is a package deal. And I don't want to put it, I put a lot of deals together. I did DMC, I did Essentia, all these things. But it's my goal not to have a situation where we're putting Band-Aids on so you can limp along for a couple more years.
That's right.
That's not what I'm looking at. What I'm looking at is to make it so that Hennepin, HCMC, North Memorial can not survive but thrive. That's what my goal is, just so you know where I'm coming from. And since we're off camera, you got to be a little careful here. Is I'm going to quote the are we still on camera?
We never break the rules. We just did this one time.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And with that, with those sage words, thank you so much, everybody, for being here. We are adjourned.